Today on Maine Calling, initiatives to protect Maine lakes and ponds. Lake season is in full swing. Blissful days floating on an inner tube, paddling a canoe, trolling for largemouth bass, or just dangling your feet in the water. Maine's lakes and ponds are precious, not just for the recreational uses, but also as a critical part of the environment. And they face many threats. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll talk with some of the people focusing on preserving and improving the quality of Maine's lakes. They are battling invasive plants, harmful algae, chemicals and pollutants, climate change, and more. We'll find out which lakes and ponds face the greatest challenges and what's being done on the front lines of the battle for clean, clear water. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine. Now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Every summer, we hear about algal blooms, and that is just one threat to the health of Maine's lakes and ponds. There are also invasive species, erosion, and human impacts. What can be done to help? Well, there are a lot of people working on this. Joining me today, a few of them, Susan Gallo, who is Executive Director of Maine Lakes, Jeremy Deeds, aquatic ecologist with Maine's Department of Environmental Protection, and Colin Holm, executive director for Lakes Environmental Association in Bridgeton. Join the conversation. Have you noticed any changes in a lake or pond that you love that is precious to you? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you. Jeremy, for those who don't know, Maine has a lot of lakes and ponds, doesn't it? What's the number?
Close to 6,000.
Close to 6,000. So the caveat for the beginning of this program is when we talk about Maine lakes and ponds, we're talking about a really wide variety of ecosystems, right?
Yeah, that's true. Like I said, we have close to 6,000 lakes and ponds. We're very lucky in Maine to have all these waters. And most of them are doing just fine. There are a few that have some issues, especially this time of year. This is the most stressful time of year for lakes in Maine. So we're seeing a lot of the issues pop up now.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask that. This is the most stressful time of the year. And what about this year in particular? I mean, you don't have to be a meteorologist to know that we really haven't had a lot of rain. We've had some really hot weekends. Has all of that impacted Maine's lakes and ponds?
Oh, certainly. So the drought is one thing, you know. But the warm weather certainly does have some effect on lakes as well. I mean, you think of Maine lakes as being deep and cold and clear. And weather like this, where we've had these extended periods of really hot weather, the water warms up as well and can get very warm, especially on the surface. And the way lakes work, colder water can hold more oxygen in the water, which is what a lot of species depend on. So as the water warms up, we lose oxygen and the habitat changes for a lot of the species that we think of as being important to Maine lakes.
Yeah. And Susan, I'll turn to you. Something that happens when you have warming water and you have changes in what species can survive is that you have invasive species, both flora and fauna, right?
Yes. And I would say, too, even though Maine lakes overall are healthy, you know, the trajectory when we have weather like this and we have warming weathers is that more and more lakes are going to be in trouble if we don't work to protect their health. And that includes everything from invasive species. You mentioned controlling invasive species, which I'm gonna let Colin answer more of that because he does a lot more of that work. But it's also things like more storms, more intense storms affecting the erosion, and we can come back to that about how erosion and those soils getting into the lakes really impact water quality, and that in those soils feeding phosphorus into the lake really feed algae. So those are problems that are growing. And I'll just say quickly that one of the things we really want to do is get more money, more funding, more work done on Maine lakes to protect, as Jeremy said, this incredible resource that we have.
So I was focused on the warmth and the drought, Susan, but what you're saying is that, if we have a series of nice, gentle rains, it doesn't affect lakes nearly as much as these big, sort of powerful storms will.
Exactly. And so a lot of people have these best management practices, these conservation practices they've installed to manage stormwater runoff. So you might have a dry well that captures water coming off your roof, or you might have a water bar across your driveway that diverts water into, a vegetative swale or a ditch alongside the road. And those are great, and they can manage that rain in a, like you said, a gentle sort of typical Maine summer storm. But when you do have these intense storms, which we are seeing, everyone has memories of recent storms that we've been in, where we get lots of rain really quickly, and then the rain can overwhelm those best management practices and lead to erosion. So, but we just need more of those conservation practices installed. We need more of them. They need to be bigger and stronger, and they really have to be able to manage these stormwater events, which are getting bigger and more intense.
Colin, Susan mentioned that you've done a lot of work with invasives and keeping them out of lakes. I know that your area, the sort of Sebago Lake, Bridgeton region, has been working on this for a long time. I'm talking a quarter century, right? You've been inspecting boats and trying to make sure they're not bringing in things like milfoil. Where do you stand in this battle against invasive species, and what are your new tools?
Sure. Thanks for the question, Jennifer. So first, I'll say, as Jeremy noted, there's 6,000 plus lakes in Maine, and I think there's 38 systems right now that have invasive species in them, and there's about eight invasive aquatic invasive species in Maine, and they kind of run up through the along the kind of Route 95 corridor, and branching out a little from it for the most part. And so the in aquatic invasive species are spreading along the popular travel corridors. And our area that we work in Lakes Environmental Association in the upper kind of Sebago watershed is a very popular spot. And so we have some of those invasive species. In our area, we're dealing with variable leaf milfoil primarily, but there are a variety of other species that are coming into Maine, and seven other species, like I said, that are already into Maine. And so, yeah, when I started back at LEA in the late 90s, we had one of the first courtesy boat inspection programs in the state, and it was very casual. And now there's inspectors all across the state who are working kind of officially to prevent plants from going in, into invasive plants from going into our lakes, and invasive plants going out as well of some of the lakes that unfortunately do have infestations. And so that program has really grown, and it's so important because we're catching, at last I checked, so far this summer, we've caught over 200 invasive plants at boat launches with inspectors. But the unfortunate thing is that inspectors are most for the most part paid, and there's not enough time to there's not enough money to pay them to cover the hours. And so people really need to be inspecting their own boat every single time. Last summer, we had a boater who came up to Highland Lake in our area, and he had been to a previous lake in Maine, Woodbury Pond, and he had Eurasian water milfoil, one of the invasive species, on his kind of pedal-powered kayak, and he hadn't checked his boat twice, and so he brought this species into two pristine Maine lakes from a from a pond in Mill Pond in Massachusetts, and he was someone who was formerly an inspector at a bass club and didn't check his boat. And the reality is, we need people to check their boat every time. So prevention is by far the key message.
One of the
But we,
things that strikes me, Colin, I'm going to stop you right there and let you return to your train of thought. But you say inspect your boat every time. And then you talked about someone's pedal-powered kayak. And I'm guessing there are people out there that aren't thinking about their kayak or their paddleboard as their boat. They think about, the fishing boat that they're putting on their trailer and backing into the lake. And maybe they're inspecting that every time. But you're saying everything you put in the water, make sure there's nothing on it, right?
absolutely. I mean, the more kind of gadgetry and things sticking out of a boat, and the more chance you're going to catch things. But the size of the boat is really irrelevant. Some of the smallest boats that we use could have the most, like a little fishing gear could have a could get the most things on it. I like to paddleboard. I catch plants on my little keel, and you gotta check your boat, your paddleboard, your kayak every single time. And really, you want it to be dry, because there are invasive species that are coming into Maine that are essentially microscopic, like the spiny water flea or the zebra mussel. And so those have little, the babies essentially can stay, you're not going to see them. And so that's why drying your vessel, your boat, your watercraft is so important too. And prevention is by far the most, the effective treatment, or effective, excuse me, way to stop these species, cost effective, from spreading. But we do we have a very large control program at Lakes Environmental Association. We have four suction harvesters and about 20 people working to re physically remove milfoil.
Okay, I'm going to stop you again. You say you have four suction harvesters. Okay, I've seen some video of these. I know what they are. What is a suction harvester and how does it work?
So it's a right now all of them are gas powered engines that essentially suck water. It's a pump system, and divers go down underwater and they hand dig out invasive plants and feed them into a tube. So the and the tube is it sucks the water, so you're not actually vacuuming the bottom of the lake. That's what kind of people think happens, but that's not it at all. You're really just the suction harvester is a way to the suction gets the plant from the bottom of the lake to the top, where it goes through a series of troughs and is filtered out. So it's a mechanism to move plants efficiently from the bottom, where they're being hand weeded, to the top of the water. And we have four of those boats right now, and very excitingly, right now we are building the first in the nation, possibly the world, electric suction harvester. So each one of those suction harvesters now has three gas engines most of the time: the outboard engine, the suction harvester engine, and the air surface supplied air. And so this new boat that we're building right now, with Shred Electric in Gloucester, Maine, is going to be 100% electric, and have everything run off that cleaner, quieter, safer. A better experience for people on the shore. We're working a better experience for our divers, and less pollution, less gas, less greenhouse gases.
Neat. I want to turn to you, Jeremy. Another thing people are concerned about and hearing a lot about are these algal blooms. A little bit of algae is okay. What's the difference between healthy and safe algae in a lake or pond, and what is concerning it, and what kind of damage can it do?
Yeah, that's a good question. So all lakes have some amount of algae, and a little bit, like you say, is okay. It feeds the base of the food chain. It helps grow fish and everything else that lives in the lake. What happens is when the nutrients in the lake get out of balance, and mostly this is phosphorus, which is coming in oftentimes from the watershed, from erosion attached to soil particles entering the lake, that is food for algae. And when the algae get this extra food, they can just continue to grow and grow and grow, especially with these conditions we've had with plenty of sunlight and warm water, which is what algae thrive on. And when this happens and the algae grows so dense, it throws off the balance of the lake ecosystem, and the species that live there don't have the are not getting their needs met because the algae is so dense. It can cloud the surface of the water, so light can't get through the water. And then one of the real adverse effects of the algae bloom is when those algal cells die, they sink to the bottom of the lake and then they decompose like a big compost pile, and that consumes all the oxygen from the bottom of the lake, which throws the lake into further state of ecological imbalance. So what we really see is, not only is it not terribly pleasant to swim in a lake that's green and slimy, but it really is not good for the creatures that live there in the lake as well.
Are there certain lakes and ponds where this is a greater concern than others? And if so, which?
Certainly. Yeah, there are lakes in, and I'm based in Augusta, and there are several lakes in our area that have issues with this. Weber Pond and Three Mile Pond are two that come to mind most immediately, and they have what we call chronic algae blooms because every year they're having this condition where, nutrients are coming in from the watershed, they're coming out of the sediment, and they're just fueling this sort of unlimited algal growth, and they're making these conditions that, like I said, they're not terribly pleasant, but they also can be dangerous because there's cyanotoxic compounds, cyanobacteria, which are used to be called blue-green algae. And but they're really actually more close to a bacterial life form, and they photosynthesize like algae, but they can also produce toxins as well. So in high densities, these cyanobacteria can make unsafe conditions. Kind of the prime example of this is a few years ago, the water supply for Erie, in Lake Erie and over in Toledo, Ohio, they couldn't use their water supply because of a harmful algal bloom, and this was because of the cyanobacteria producing those toxins. So we do see toxins in Maine on some of these lakes when the algal blooms get dense, especially this time of year. We're starting to see these dense blooms, these surface scums of algae in lakes this time of year, especially with these warmer conditions.
Jeremy, if I'm listening to this program and I'm on one of those lakes, what could I be doing to help?
Well, most immediately, you want to familiarize yourself with what a cyanobacteria bloom actually looks like, because there are a lot of things you can see in the water that might not be harmful. So what I would do is go to the DEP website has some great guidance on what a cyanobacteria bloom looks like and what it is, and what the sort of things to look out for to know if it might be potentially unsafe for your kids or your pets or anyone using the water. And outside of that, stepping back for a bigger picture, what you really need to do to ameliorate this condition is to keep phosphorus out of the lake. So that's reducing erosion. That is armoring, riparian areas, the vegetation along the lake shore and in the tributary streams to keep the soil on land out of the lake. Maine Lakes, Susan runs Maine Lakes, and they have a Lake Smart program, which is a great way for landowners to get involved in Lakes Environmental Association, and it's involved in Lake Smart as well. And they work with directly with landowners to talk about the best management practices and how to best manage their property to help keep the lake healthy and keep soil and sediment out of the lake to prevent algae blooms.
All right. Well, we do need to take a quick break. We're talking about Maine's lakes and ponds and their health. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. What makes a lake healthy or unhealthy? We are discussing the variety of threats affecting lakes across the state, as well as efforts to help. With me today, Jeremy Deeds, an aquatic ecologist with the Maine Department of Environmental Protection, Colin Holm, Executive Director for Lakes Environmental Association, and Susan Gallo, Executive Director for Maine Lakes. We invite you to join the conversation. Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now is Lydie Robbins, who is Executive Director of 30 Mile Watershed Association. Lydie, thanks for calling, and I'm going to ask you, what 30 miles are you representing?
Hi, thanks for having me. Yeah, the organization's the 30 Mile River Watershed Association, and It's actually not 30 miles of lakes and ponds, but it's about 25 lakes, ponds, and streams in central Maine that we work to protect. The name goes back to the 1700s and was given that name by some land surveyors at the time. But we do have a lot of lakes and ponds that we're working on.
Okay, so we were just talking about algal blooms on Maine Calling, and I know that you are focusing on the algal blooms on Androscoggin Lake. What can you tell me about why they're happening and how dangerous they are?
Yeah, the blooms on Androscoggin Lake, the recent blooms started happening back in 2021, and four out of the last five summers, the lake has bloomed. It hasn't bloomed yet this summer. We're hoping it will hold off for a while yet. The worst bloom was last year, and the water clarity was below 1 meter, so that put it into the DEP's category of being a harmful algal bloom. So starting in mid-August, people were advised to stay out of the lake and keep their pets out of the lake. Swimming would not be safe.
Yeah, so what are some of the things that you all are doing to address it?
Well, once it started blooming in 2021, we ramped up our water quality monitoring. We were already doing water quality monitoring, but we started doing a lot more of it, checking dissolved oxygen, checking lots of phosphorus levels and the clarity. But last year, with a harmful algal bloom happening, we had to really ramp up our efforts. So we've intensified the monitoring that we've been doing. We'll be looking at lake sediments this fall. We've hired an environmental consultant and engineers who will help to do a lot of data analysis and modeling and analyzing potential solutions. We've also been working a lot with the community. So we've formed a steering committee that's made up of members of the Lake Association, 30 Mile, the local towns, because this is really much more than just a lakefront property owner issue. It's really a townwide issue. When these lakes are so vital to the identity of the towns and the way of life and the property taxes. So they really go beyond just those who own property in the lake, but everyone who benefits from the lakes in some ways. So we've got a lot of volunteers who are working with us in communications and fundraising and the science and helping us to get the broader community involved, keeping people informed and engaged in this big issue that at the end of the day is probably going to cost millions of dollars to fix.
Lydie, thank you so much for calling in. Lydie Robbins is executive director of the 30 Mile River Watershed Association. Thank you. And Susan, Lydie was talking about the importance of getting community involved, that this, it's not okay for a small group of volunteers to be focused on any lake or pond, but pretty much everyone who touches that lake or pond needs to understand some of the dynamics at work.
Sure. And I will mention quickly, there's a lot of lake organizations across the street, across the state, like Lydie's, have volunteer programs, but a couple of key programs related to water quality, Lake Stewards of Maine, they're based in Auburn. They train people across the state to monitor lake water quality. And there's not enough seats at the table at Maine Calling to have all the people at the table. When we talk about lakes, but so there wasn't room to have them today join us, but they're a great organization and do a ton of training. And if anybody wants to get involved with learning how to monitor lake water quality, they should check out Lake Stewards of Maine. Maine Lakes has the Lake Smart program Jeremy mentioned. We train about 120-ish volunteers, and they go out and look for erosion that we talked about earlier. They visit property owners, look for erosion, and help homeowners understand their role. And so that's another volunteer program. So now I got off track a little bit on volunteer programs. I think
that's okay, but let me ask you. I'll turn to Colin because I know all of you are involved in the Lake Protection Coalition, which is new.
Thanks for that lead in, Jennifer. So, and what Susan just said and Lighty touched on too, I think is really important for understanding why we need the new Lake Protection and Coalition. And so, lakes are critical to Maine's way of life in rural communities and quality of life. And it is a townwide community issue. And so we do have groups like Maine Lakes and Lake Stewards of Maine and 30 Mile and the DEP that are working on these issues to try to keep our lakes clean. But we need a broader base of support. And there's so many people who are in the community and on these lakes who care so deeply about these issues of, and seeing more lakes bloom every year and seeing more invasive species, and they're trying to get involved. And so in 2025, a group of lake associations across the state who have been meeting informally for years, and weighing in on regional and statewide lake issues form the Lake Protection Coalition, to try to, raise the bar for lake issues. There are policies that come up every year. There are laws that need to be updated, probably new laws that need to be put in there, and maybe old laws that need to be revisited. But more, most importantly, I think, is something that Susan touched on earlier, is there's not enough emphasis or funding within the state to address the issues that we're seeing today. One algal bloom on a lake can cost $1 million or $2 million. Towns don't have the resources to deal with it. And invasive species, like I was talking about earlier, though we spend close to $300,000 a year trying to control them, there's just a huge need for resources. And there's a huge value here. And people, there's a little bit sometimes a failure to understand the risk. Once you get to that blooming lake, it's harder to get back to an unblooming lake. Once you have a lake full of invasive plants, it's harder to get back, and it costs more. And we need people from all over the community to weigh in and make our voices heard when it comes to statewide issues. And so this Lake Protection Coalition is hopefully going to help us do that.
We'll go to Jim calling from West Newfield. Hi, Jim, go ahead.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to thank the state for helping with milfoil. You just cleaned out our pond, and we can swim in front of our place now, so that's very nice. Thank you. And then I would like to ask about phosphorus. Where does it come from people? My understanding is like soap and laundry products. And what kind of products can we get that don't do that? And what about the role of septic tanks releasing phosphorus through their leach fields into the water system?
Okay, Jeremy, a bunch of questions there. I'm going to pass them to you. I remember, and I'm old, so I remember going to Girl Scout camp and taking a bath in a lake using a bar of soap. Is that causing phosphorus in the lakes? And if so, or if not, what else do we need to be concerned about?
Well, yeah, you probably contributed to the phosphorus load, Jen. I'm sorry to hear that. But I think, a lot of soaps now are phosphorus free, but you should always check that you are using phosphorus free soap, especially dishwasher. There are some laws that have been passed to keep phosphorus out of laundry detergent and dishwasher soap. But phosphorus is a naturally occurring element on Earth in the soil. And what happens is when that soil gets disturbed, it's transported into the lake. That's more of a natural sort of process. What happens when lots of people live near a lake? All of the use of all these products in the septic tanks and the systems add extra phosphorus to the lake. And not only add extra phosphorus, but they add it in this form that's really easily digestible and usable by algae. Septic effluent is a great case. It's liquid form. It can be used. So you can't really stress enough the importance of getting your septic tank maintained and pumped out and up to code and all these things. And that's all along often kind of a great unknown about what's going on around the lake is what's going on in the septic.
Yeah, so it sounds to me as though Jim is trying to be a good steward and trying to do the right thing. When he goes to the store and buys products, what he needs to look for is something that says phosphorus free. Is there anything else that he needs to be aware of or think about?
Yeah, a big thing around lakes is, you know, just maintaining your property. If you have a lawn, you know, if you need to fertilize your lawn to get something to grow, use phosphorus free fertilizer. That's kind of the biggest culprit around lakes that have a lot of development is people fertilizing their lawn. Even better than maintaining any kind of lawn is just having sort of natural shrubs, native plants like blueberry bushes and plants that are normally found around lakes. Leaving those in place are much better for the lake than establishing, you know, this big infrastructure of driveways and lawns and all these things that need to be maintained, which also takes time away from enjoying your property on the lake, but is also introducing things to the lake that you might not want to be there. So again, we keep talking about LakeSmart, because even if you don't go through the program, there's great resources out there to figure out what's best to do on your piece of property if you're on a lake.
And Susan, it sounds to me like Jim lives on a lake, but when Jeremy's talking about not using fertilizer, this is within the entire watershed, right? Phosphorus, for much further away from the shoreline, can really make a, or it can really harm a lake.
Yeah, absolutely. We really concentrate on the shoreline homeowners as kind of the last line of defense, you know, as the water's coming down from throughout the watershed. But certainly, anywhere, if you can stop erosion anywhere, you're in, you're helping protect whatever water source is downstream from you. And we know from evidence in Maine, if there's a really poor logging job, say that's done 2 miles away from a lake, but upstream, that lake is going to see impacts from that, you know, from a poor logging job, where that, what Jeremy mentioned, you know, removing the vegetation and removing the, all the pieces that hold the soil in place, when those are all gone on, I mean, in this case, the evidence I'm thinking of is large scale logging, and you, then you can really see it in a lake, but certainly small scale will also have an impact. And my, I took over from the executive director, Maggie Shannon at Maine Lakes, and she always used to say, lakes die a death from 1,000 cuts. And so she always framed it as each homeowner, each property, piece of property, it may contribute a little bit, you know, it might just be a little bit of erosion a few times a year, or maybe it's a little bit of erosion all year long, but then you got to add those up. If you have, you know, 100 camps or 500 camps around a lake, and if every camp is contributing a little bit, then in the end, you're going to have a big problem for the lake. And I think that's one thing for people, they look at their erosion and they think, ah, oh, that's not that big. You know, it's not that big a deal. But then you have to multiply that by the number of homeowners in the watershed. And when those all add up, that's when you have those, that's how you get algal blooms. That's how you get excess phosphorus in the water.
And Jeremy, you are mentioning native plants like blueberries. And I know that we're learning more and more about how native plants and forests can actually help mitigate some of the harms from the way that we live today, whether it's logging or farming or fertilizing our yards. Tell me what we're learning about the area around a lake and a pond, and how it can, how important it is to preserve it, but to preserve it in a certain way.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it, the phrase has been used already today, that the lake shore and the riparian area near water on the lake are flowing into is kind of the last line of defense for keeping these things out of the lake that we don't want to be introduced to the water, the soil and the phosphorus and things. The network of roots of this vegetation, the shrubs and the trees, hold the soil back. The canopy, the leaves high in the tree and closer to the ground, reduce the energy of the water falling to the ground, which can create a lot of erosion. So we're also learning a lot about the kind of the structure of the forests near the lakeshore, because that contributes to that structure, the habitat structure that species need. You know, the things like we like to watch, like dragonflies and turtles and little fish and big fish, all depend on that shallow area near the lakes for their life cycle, how they can succeed in the lake. And when you remove the vegetation from the lakeshore, especially, you lose a lot of that structure and they don't have the habitat that they need to survive. And as we talk about, you know, we talked about the big storms and the more intense rainfall and things, it's even more important that we sort of keep these areas well vegetated and strengthen the ability of the soil to be retained in light of all these storms.
So many calls coming in. We'll go to Joanne calling from Naples. Hi, Joanne. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks so much for this program. I want to share with you, I benefited from being a 20-year member of Lakes Environmental Association, not only as a lakefront homeowner, but also as part of a homeowners association. LEA is a great resource for them. I've been a longtime fan of Colin Holm. I remember Colin when he was first analyzing water for us on the boats. And since then, he's come down many times to our property and our road, leading in from the secondary road, to give our homeowners association tips on the best things we could do to maintain that road. And also, both he and his wife have had a career-long commitment to all aspects of watershed safety, and I want to thank them for that. I'd like to share their website with your listeners. It's a terrific resource. It highlights all aspects of their work. It's MaineLakes, all one string, .org, MaineLakes.org. And they also have a science center in Bridgeton with free community education classes that are excellent, as well as all year long they have school education programs and fun events for every age group. So I'm so glad Colin joined you today. Thanks.
Well, Joanne calling from Naples, thank you for your call. You have a fan, Colin, and you are Joanne has brought a smile to all three guests' face. On that note, we do need to take a second break. So many calls coming in. We'll get to so many more of them after that. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. A lake may look expansive and beautiful, but it is also vulnerable, and we're learning about threats to Maine's lakes and ponds and what can be done. My guest today, Colin Holm with the Lakes Environmental Association, Susan Gallo with Maine Lakes, and Jeremy Deeds with Maine DEP. Share your comments and questions. Send us a brief email. Be quick about it. talk@mainpublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Steve calling from Lovell. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to comment about the septic system nutrient loading issue. I'm with the Keyser Lake Watershed Association, and what we have learned is that in the state of Maine, there are no requirements, no laws, no anything other than you're supposed to keep it well maintained, but they don't define that at all about septic systems. And so we're trying to get a town ordinance to have septic systems that are by the shoreline maintained on a very reasonable schedule.
Ah, and, interesting. Yeah, I'm going to turn this to Colin. Colin, one, is that true? Is there no state law about maintenance of septic systems?
Close. I would say it's that's fairly accurate. The I guess there's a couple laws on transfer of property that you need to get your system inspected in the shoreline zone. And that was something we pushed for. Many of the people, you know, in the Maine Lakes and in the new Lake Protection Coalition before it formed, pushed for that because a lot of times property transfers and, you know, they have old cesspools or septic systems that haven't been inspected in many, many years and people don't understand them. And we wanted that. We thought on the sale of a property, it's a good time to do an assessment. And so that passed, I don't know, 5 years ago. But unfortunately, I would say in the real estate market has been so hot in Maine that buyers and sellers are that the sale goes through so quickly that people aren't requesting this, you know, an assessment of the septic system, even though it's required now. So I think what Steve is getting at is there's a concern that a lot of systems, unless they're actively, you know, stuff is coming up to the surface or there's a smell, barring that, there's no requirement that systems be maintained or pumped. And so that's a real concern. And there are soils in Maine where where the effluent from a tank goes, it goes to a leach field generally, and then percolates down through the soil. And there are some soils in Maine that are very well drained. And so that those nutrients and those pathogens could possibly go right through into the lake. And I suspect that's another concern that Steve is getting at, and our organization is trying to look in whether that's affecting the lake. And I'm sure DEP as well, through bacterial testing, through optical brighteners and things like that. But it's a hard nut to crack.
Yeah, and let me Steve, thank you for your call. Jim, who called earlier, wanted to ask about septic systems and also about phosphorus. Colin, I understand you have something to add to the thoughts about phosphorus in Maine lakes.
Well, I just Jim's question or about where phosphorus is coming from, and then kind of and thinking soaps and fertilizers is a very, very common one that we hear all the time. And Susan and Jeremy really explain that's, you know, those are certainly culprits, but the big culprit is soil erosion. And I think, Jennifer, you kind of alluded to this earlier, looking at the whole watershed. And what we found, what research has shown from across the country is that when you have more than 20 to 25% of a watershed developed, that's just residential housing. It's not necessarily logging or some huge construction site. It's housing, it's businesses, it's what we all use to survive and live. But when you have more than 20 to 25% of the watershed developed, then you start to see noticeable changes in water quality. And the way to, it's those little things and somebody's lawn, clearing, smoothing your property out and draining your property into a ditch that drains to a stream. And so there's ways to reduce that impact. And that's where towns can really get involved in thinking about what kind of development they want through planning boards, through code officers, through thoughtful development. And that takes resources and oversight and training. And those are things that our organization and the Lake Protection Coalition are really trying to push for right now.
We'll go to Jack calling from Damariscotta. Hi, Jack. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm as a member of CoastalRivers.org in Damariscotta. I used to do volunteer work for Lake Smart Inspections, among other things. And we always would tell people that start out as a DEP program, but people didn't want to hear, "I'm from the government, I'm here to help you." But indeed, we were volunteers, and we tried to push home the point that that there are property values if the water that they're on, like a lake or a pond, deteriorates, their property values fall much faster. And so it's to help them help themselves. And so keeping the five layers of protection for waterfront property within the shoreland zone, big trees, small trees, big bushes, small bushes, plus the duff that's underneath of them. They're so very important. And we've actually tried to encouraging the same thing along the rivers and saltwater frontage, because there's so many properties that people just cut everything down between their house and the waterfront. And that same concept applies there. And then also, of course, the trees and stuff help keep the coastal waters cool, like mm-hmm. along the shorefront. And that's so important for the fish in a healthy ecosystem. And so...
Yeah, Jack, thank you so much. I saw, I saw our guests nodding as you were speaking. And Jeremy, we know from previous programs we've done in Maine Calling about rivers is that it's really important to have trees over rivers to keep mm-hmm. the rivers cool. And it changes their entire ecosystem if it gets too hot.
It sure does. And I was hoping duff might come up during this conversation. So duff is the spongy layer on the bottom on the forest floor. So the leaves and pine needles, and when you walk, it feels soft. And that duff layer is so important because it acts like a sponge for water that's falling, for rain that's falling. If you compare that rainwater falling to a driveway or a lawn, and the water just kind of runs off quickly, it gets more energy, it carries more soil into the water. So part of those five layers of canopy, we talked about the leaves flowing down the rainwater and the roots holding the soil together. The duff is an important part of that. And maintaining, you know, filtering the water before it enters the streams or the lake is important, but also just the shade that this vegetation provides is really important for maintaining cool waters, especially with this weather spell we've been having this summer.
Thanks for your call, Jack. We'll go to Amanda in Falmouth. Hi, Amanda. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm loving all the talk of like the importance of vegetative buffers and all of that. I'm a landscape designer in Falmouth, and I just wanted to make a note about permitting and the importance of permitting. As kind of boring a subject as it sometimes is, I encounter a lot where I go out to a lakefront property and the homeowner has all these ideas about what they want to do and find out they can't do half of it or any of it. So really, like, even maybe before you buy a property, or at least when you're kind of newly having these ideas, homeowners should really talk to, like, town code enforcement, because towns have their own rules, and talk to the DEP, because the state has rules as well, and just kind of figure out what's possible on a property, because I think people are often surprised at, like, what they can and can't do and what their limits are and how big the buffers actually are, like, how much that encompasses on their property. So just a note on that and how important it is to have all the permits in place before you actually start working.
Amanda, thank you. I saw Colin nodding. Colin, you and Amanda are on the same page.
Yeah, well, there are complex laws, particularly right around the water. And that's why our lakes are clean. That's why people want to come to Maine. That's why everybody wants to live on the lake and recreate on it. But Amanda's right, you know, this is for most people, they don't, you know, most people don't understand them all. So the first thing you want to do is get somebody in, an expert. If you can get the code officer in, if you can get DEP or a consultant, a Lake Smart evaluation. If you have Lake Smart, they can kind of walk you through. We have a program called Clean Lake Checkup, where we send staff out and we'll walk the property with someone to help them understand not only what they can and cannot do, but what's good for the lake and the reason for some of these laws. And it is complex. So I think always it's a great idea to get an expert in there to give some advice.
All right, Susan.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add, you know, with the prevalence of AI and, you know, generative AI giving you answers when you type in, do I need a permit for XYZ? I think that's a growing problem. And we all know we've all tried it. And, you know, you don't always get the right answers. So I just strongly encourage people not only to take that caller's advice, you absolutely need to follow up with permits and you need to get information from trusted sources. And that's Maine Lakes, Lake Stewards of Maine, Lakes Environmental, all these groups that are here today, 30 Mile River, we're here to provide resources and support for information like this. So just encourage people, do not count on AI answers for your lake permitting, lake conservation, lake practice work.
An email here from Bruce. In the 1980s, there started to be real traction in testing waterfront areas for effluent coming from bad septics. As part of that effort in Brunswick, it was found that cows miles away from the affected waterway were contributing heavily to the effluent load in addition to bad septics. The land between the cow farms and the water was primarily clay, so the surface water was not being absorbed. Bruce asks, how is China Lake doing these days? It was also affected heavily by agricultural runoff in the 80s. So, Jeremy, what can you tell us about China Lake?
China Lake is doing pretty well. It has sort of good years and bad years. The last couple of years have been very good. But I think everyone on that lake knows that the problems haven't been solved. They just have had a couple of good years. And dealing with this, what we call legacy phosphorus, where, you know, old dairy farms and old significant inputs of phosphorus that may not be active now, that load of phosphorus is still in the lake. And what happens in some lakes is when you lose the oxygen from the bottom of the lake, like we talked about earlier, that pulls phosphorus from the sediment and redistributes through the water column so it can fuel more algae blooms. And that can happen on China Lake given the right weather conditions. And that happens on many lakes across the state. So, you know, we think about the weather and the conditions year to year. The weather that we're having in any given year affects lakes differently. Some lakes will have good years and drought years. Some lakes will have bad years and drought years. But that can be lake specific.
All right. Well, that will be our last question today. We're out of time. Thank you all for joining us. The voice you just heard, Jeremy Deeds, an aquatic ecologist with the Maine Department of Environmental Protection. Also, Susan Gallo, Executive Director of Maine Lakes. And Colin Holm is the Executive Director for the Lakes Environmental Association in Bridgeton. Our sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we listen back to our earlier show about astronomy. And the reason we're airing that show tomorrow is that tomorrow is the peak night of the Perseid meteor showers, and there is a partial solar eclipse. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.